Well, well, aren't we nervous, she chided. Sean Fordyce was a New York-based talk show host who'd found a niche on cable sensationalizing murder cases. His slant was unapologetically from the right side of the street, always in support of the latest execution or gun rights, or the rounding up of illegal immigrants, a group he loved to attack because they were much easier targets than others with dark skin. It was hardly original programming, but Fordyce struck gold when he began filming the families of victims as they prepared to watch the executions. He became famous when his tech crew managed to successfully hide a tiny camera in the frame of a pair of eyeglasses worn by the father of a young boy who was murdered in Alabama. For the first time, the world saw an execution, and Sean Fordyce owned the footage. He played it and played it, and with each showing, commented on how simple it was, how peaceful and painless, and much too easy for such a violent killer. He was indicted in Alabama, sued by the dead man's family, and threatened with death and censure. But he survived it. The charges didn't stick. They couldn't nail down a specific crime. The lawsuit was thrown out. 3 years after the stunt, he was not only standing, but standing at the top of the cable garbage heap. Now he was in Sloan, preparing for another episode. Rumor was that he'd paid Reva $50,000 for the exclusive. "Please reconsider, Reva," Coffey said. "No, Paul. The answer is no. I'm doing it for Nicole, for my family, and for the other victims out there. The world needs to see what this monster has done to us." "What's the benefit?" Coffey said. Both he and Kerber had ignored phone calls from Fordyce's production team. "Maybe the laws can be changed."
"But the laws are working here, Reva. Sure, it's taken longer than we wanted, but in the scheme of things, 9 years is not bad."
"Oh my God, Paul, I can't believe you just said that. You haven't lived our nightmare for the past 9 years."
"No, I haven't. And I don't pretend to understand what you've been through. But the nightmare won't end Thursday night."
"And it certainly would not. Not if Reva had anything to do with it." "You have no idea, Paul. I can't believe this. The answer is no, 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 no. I'm doing the interview and the show will run. The world will see what it's like." They had not expected to be successful, so they were not surprised. When Reva Pike made up her mind, the conversation was over. They shifted gears.
"So be it," Coffey said. "Do you and Wallace feel safe?"
She smiled and almost chuckled.
"Of course, Paul. We got a house full of guns and the neighbors are on high alert. Every car that comes down this street is watched through rifle scopes. We are not expecting trouble."
"There were phone calls at the station today," Kerber said. "The usual anonymous stuff, vague threats about this and that if the boy is executed."
"I'm sure you guys can deal with it," she said with no concern whatsoever. After waging such a relentless war of her own, Reva had forgotten how to be afraid.
"I think we should have a patrol car parked outside for the rest of the week," Kerber said.
"Do as you wish. It doesn't matter to me. If the blacks start trouble, they won't do it over here. Don't they normally burn their own buildings first?" Both men shrugged. They'd had no experience with riots. Sloan had an unremarkable history with race relations. What little they knew had been learned from the television news. Yes, it did seem as if the riots were confined to the ghettos. They talked about this for a few minutes. Then it was time to leave. They hugged again at the front door and promised to see each other after the execution, at the prison in Huntsville. What a great moment it would be. The end of the ordeal. Justice at last. Robbie Flack parked at the curb in front of the Drum home and braced himself for another meeting.
"How many times have you been here?" his passenger asked.
"I don't know. Dozens and dozens."
He opened the door, climbed out, and she did the same. Her name was Martha Handler. She was an investigative journalist, a freelancer who worked for no one but was paid occasionally by the big magazines.
She had first visited Sloan 2 years earlier when the Paul Coffey scandal broke, and after that had developed a fascination with the drum case. She and Robbie had spent hours together, professionally, and things might have degenerated from there but for the fact that Robbie was committed to his current live-in, a woman 20 years his junior. Martha no longer believed in commitment and gave mixed signals as to whether the door was open or not. There was sexual tension between the two, as if they were both fighting the urge to say yes. So far, they had been successful. At first, she claimed to be writing a book about the drum case. Then it was a lengthy article for Vanity Fair. Then it was one for The New Yorker. Then it was a screenplay for a movie to be produced by one of her ex-husbands in L.A. In Robbie's opinion, she was a passable writer, with a brilliant recall of the facts, but a disaster with organization and planning. Whatever the final product, he had complete veto power. And if her project ever earned a dime, he and the Drum family would get a share. After 2 years with her, he was not counting on any payoff. He liked her, though. She was wickedly funny, irreverent, a total zealot to the cause, and she had developed a fierce hatred for almost every person she'd met in Texas. Plus, she could guzzle bourbon and play poker far past midnight. The small living room was crowded. Roberta Drum sat on the piano bench, her usual position. Two of her brothers stood by the door to the kitchen. Her son Cedric, Dante's oldest brother, was on the sofa holding a toddler who was asleep. Her daughter, Andrea, Dante's younger sister, had one chair. Her preacher, Reverend Canty, had another. Robbie and Martha sat close to each other in flimsy, shaky chairs brought in from the kitchen. Martha had been there many times, and had even cooked for Roberta when she had the flu. After the usual hellos and hugs and instant coffee, Robbie began talking. "Nothing happened today, which is not good news. First thing tomorrow, the parole board will issue its decision. They don't meet, they just circulate the case and everybody votes. We don't expect a recommendation for clemency. That rarely happens. We expect a denial, which we will then appeal to the governor's office and ask for a reprieve. The governor has the right to grant 1 30-day reprieve. It's unlikely we'll get one, but we have to pray for a miracle." Robbie Flack was not a man of prayer, but in the staunch Bible Belt of East Texas, he could certainly talk the talk. And he was in a room full of people who prayed around the clock, Martha Handler being the exception. "On the positive side, we made contact today with Joey Gamble, found him outside of Houston, a place called Mission Bend. Our investigator had lunch with him, confronted him with the truth, impressed upon him the urgency of the situation, and so on. He's following the case and knows what's at stake. We invited him to sign an affidavit recanting the lies he told at trial, and he declined. However, we won't give up. He was not decisive. He seemed to waver, to be troubled by what's happening to Dante." "What if he signs an affidavit and tells the truth?" Cedric asked. "Well, we suddenly have some ammunition, a bullet or two, something to take to court and make some noise. The problem, though, is that when liars start recanting their testimony, everybody gets real suspicious, especially judges hearing appeals. When does the lying stop? Is he lying now or was he lying then? It's a long shot, frankly, but right now everything is a long shot." Robbie had always been blunt, especially when dealing with the families of his criminal clients. And at this stage in Dante's case, it made little sense to raise hopes. Roberta sat stoically with her hands wedged under her legs. She was 56 years old, but looked much older. Since the death of her husband, Riley, 5 years earlier, she had stopped coloring her hair and stopped eating. She was gray and gaunt and said little. But then she never had said much. Riley had been the big talker, the boaster, the bruiser, with Roberta in the role as the fixer who eased behind her husband and patched up the rifts he created. In the past few days, she had slowly accepted reality and seemed overwhelmed by it. Neither she nor Riley nor any member of the family had ever questioned Dante's innocence. He had once tried to maim ball carriers and quarterbacks, and he could adequately defend himself when necessary on the playground or in the streets. But Dante was really a pushover, a sensitive kid who would never harm an innocent person. Martha and I are going to Polunsky tomorrow to see Dante, Robbie was saying. I can take any mail you might have for him.
I have a meeting with the mayor at 10 a.m. tomorrow, Reverend Canty announced. I'll be joined by several other pastors. We intend to convey our concerns about what might happen in Sloan if Dante is executed.
It'll be ugly, said an uncle.
You got that right, Cedric added. Folks on this side are fired up.
The execution is still set for 6 p.m. on Thursday, right? Asked Andrea.
Yes, Robbie said.
Well, when will you know for sure that it'll be carried out? She asked.
These things usually go down to the wire, primarily because the lawyers fight to the last minute.
Andrea looked uneasily at Cedric, then said, Well, I'll just tell you, Robbie. A lot of people on this side of town plan to get out of here when it happens. There's gonna be trouble, and I understand why. But once it starts, things might get out of control.
The whole town better look out, Cedric said.
That's what we'll tell the mayor, Canty said. He'd better do something.
All he can do is react, Robbie said. He has nothing to do with the execution.
Can't he call the governor?
Sure, but don't assume the mayor is against the execution. If he got through to the governor, he'd probably lobby against a reprieve. The mayor's a good old Texas boy. He loves the death penalty. No one in the room was fond of the mayor, or the governor for that matter. Robbie moved the discussion away from the prospect of violence. There were important details to be discussed. According to the rules from the Department of Corrections, the last family visit will take place at 8 a.m. on Thursday morning at the Polunsky unit before Dante is transferred to Huntsville. Robbie continued. I know you'll be anxious to see him, and he's desperate to see you. But don't be surprised when you get there. It will be just like a regular visit. He'll be on one side of a sheet of plexiglass. You'll have to stay on the other. You talk by phone. It's ridiculous, but then this is Texas.
No hugs? No kisses? Andrea said.
No, they have their rules. Roberta began crying. Quiet sniffles with big tears.
I can't hug my baby, she said.
One of her brothers handed her a tissue and patted her shoulder. After a minute or so, she pulled herself together and said, I'm sorry.
Don't be sorry, Roberta, Robbie said. You're the mother, and your son is about to be executed for something he didn't do.
You have the right to cry. Me, I'd be bawling and screaming and shooting at people. Still might do it.
Andrea asked, What about the execution itself? Who's supposed to be there?
The witness room is divided by a wall to separate the victim's family from the inmate's family. All witnesses stand. There are no seats. They get 5 slots. You get 5 slots. The rest are given to the lawyers, prison officials, members of the press, and a few others. I'll be there. Roberta, I know you plan to be a witness, but Dante is adamant that he doesn't want you there. Your name is on his list, but he doesn't want you to watch.
I'm sorry, Robbie, she said, wiping her nose. We've had this discussion. I was there when he was born, and I'll be there when he dies. He may not know it, but he'll need me. I will be a witness.
Robbie wasn't about to argue. He promised to return the following evening. Chapter 7. Long after the boys were asleep, Keith and Dana Schroeder were in the kitchen of their modest, church-owned parsonage in central Topeka. They sat directly across from each other, each with a laptop, notepads, and decaf coffee. The table was littered with materials found on the internet and printed in the church office. Dinner had been quick, macaroni and cheese, because the boys had homework and the parents were preoccupied. Checking online sources, Dana had been unable to confirm Boyette's claim that he had been arrested and jailed in Sloan in January 1999. The town's old court records were not available.
The bar directory listed 131 lawyers in Sloan. She picked 10 at random, called them, said she was with the parole office in Kansas and was checking the background of a Mr. Travis Boyette. Did you ever represent a man by that name? No. Then sorry to disturb you. She did not have the time to call every lawyer, and it seemed futile anyway. She planned to call the city court clerk's office first thing Tuesday morning. After holding Nicole's class ring, Keith had little doubt that Boyette was telling the truth. What if the ring had been stolen before she disappeared, Dana asked, and fenced at a pawn shop? What if? It seemed unlikely Boyette would purchase such a ring from a pawn shop, didn't it? Back and forth they went for hours, each questioning every idea the other had. Much of the material scattered around the table came from two websites, WeMissYouNikki.com and FreeDanteDrum.com. Dante's website was maintained by the law offices of Mr. Robbie Flack and was far more extensive, active, and professionally done. Nikki's website was run by her mother. Neither made the slightest effort at neutrality. From Dante's, under the tab for case history, Keith scrolled down to the heart of the prosecution's case, the confession. The narrative began by explaining that it was based on two very different accounts of what happened. The interrogation, which took place over a period of 15 hours and 12 minutes, proceeded with few interruptions. Dante was allowed to use the restroom three times and was twice escorted down the hall to another room for polygraph exams. Otherwise, he never left the room, which had the in-house nickname, the choir room. Sooner or later, the cops like to say, the suspects start singing. The first version was based on the official police report. This consisted of notes taken throughout the interrogation by Detective Jim Morrissey. During one three-hour stretch, while Morrissey took a nap on a cot in the locker room, the notes were taken by Detective Nick Needham. The notes were typed into a neat 14-page report, which Detectives Kerber, Morrissey, and Needham swore to be the truth and nothing but. Not a single word in the report suggests the use of threats, lies, promises, trickery, intimidation, physical abuse, or violations of constitutional rights. Indeed, all of the above were denied repeatedly in court by the detectives. The second version contrasted sharply with the first. The day after his arrest, while Dante was alone in a jail cell, charged with kidnapping, aggravated rape, and capital murder, and while he was slowly recuperating from the psychological trauma of the interrogation, he recanted his confession. He explained to his lawyer, Robbie Flack, what had happened. Under Flack's direction, Dante began writing his account of the interrogation. When it was finished 2 days later, it was typed by one of Mr. Flack's legal secretaries. Dante's version was 43 pages long. Thus, a summary of the two accounts with some analysis thrown in. The confession. On December 22, 1998, 18 days after the disappearance of Nicole Yarber, Detectives Drew Kerber and Jim Morrissey of the Sloan Police Department drove to the Southside Health Club looking for Dante. The club is frequented by the more serious athletes in the area. Dante worked out there almost every afternoon after school. He lifted weights and was rehabbing his ankle. He was in superb physical condition and was planning to enroll at Sam Houston State University the next summer, then try out for the football team as a walk-on. At approximately 5 p.m., as Dante was leaving the club alone, he was approached by Kerber and Morrissey, who introduced themselves in a friendly manner and asked Dante if he would talk to them about Nicole Yarber. Dante agreed, and Kerber suggested they meet at the police station, where they could relax and be more comfortable. Dante was nervous about this, but he also wanted to cooperate fully. He knew Nicole. He'd helped search for her, but knew nothing about her disappearance, and thought that the meeting at the station would take just a few minutes. He drove himself in the family's well-used green Ford van to the police station and parked in a visitor's slot. As he walked into the station, he had no idea that he was taking his last steps as a free man. He was 18 years old, had never been in serious trouble, and had never been subjected to a prolonged police interrogation. He was checked in at the front desk. His cell phone, wallet, and car keys were taken and put in a locked drawer for security reasons. The detectives led him to an interrogation room in the basement of the building. Other officers were around. One, a black policeman in uniform, recognized Dante and said something about football. Once inside the interrogation room, Morrissey offered him something to drink. Dante declined. There was a small rectangular table in the center of the room. Dante sat on one side, both detectives on the other. The room was well lit with no windows. In one corner, a tripod held a video camera, but it was not directed at Dante, as far as he could tell, nor did it appear to be turned on. Morrissey produced a sheet of paper and explained that Dante needed to understand his Miranda rights. Dante asked if he was a witness or a suspect. The detective explained their procedures required that all persons interrogated be informed of their rights. No big deal. Just a formality. Dante began to feel uncomfortable. He read every word on the paper and, since he had nothing to hide, signed his name, thus waiving his right to remain silent and his right to an attorney. It was a fateful, tragic decision. Innocent people are much likelier to waive their rights during an interrogation. They know they are innocent, and they want to cooperate with the police to prove their innocence. Guilty suspects are more inclined not to cooperate. Seasoned criminals laugh at the police and clam up. Morrissey took notes, beginning with the time the suspect entered the room. 5:25 p.m. Kerber did most of the talking. The discussion began with a long summary of the football season, the wins, the losses, what went wrong in the playoffs, a coaching change that was the hot rumor. Kerber seemed truly interested in his future and hoped his ankle healed so he could play in college. Dante expressed confidence that this would happen. Kerber seemed especially interested in Dante's current weightlifting program and asked specific questions about how much he could bench press, curl, squat, and deadlift. There were a lot of questions about him and his family, his academic progress, his work experience, his brief run-in with the law on that marijuana thing when he was 16. And after what seemed like an hour, they finally got around to Nicole. The tone changed. The smiles were gone. The questions became more pointed. How long had he known her? How many classes together? Mutual friends? Whom did he date? Who were his girlfriends? Whom did she date? Did he ever date Nicole? No. Did he ever try to date her? No. Did he want to date her? He wanted to date a lot of girls. White girls? Sure, he wanted to, but he didn't. Never dated a white girl? No. Rumor has it that you and Nicole were seeing each other, trying to keep it quiet. Nope. Never met her privately, never touched her. But you admit you wanted to date her. I said I wanted to date a lot of girls, white and black, even a couple of Hispanic. So you love all girls? A lot of them, yes, but not all. Kerber asked if Dante had participated in any of the searches for Nicole. Yes, Dante and the entire senior class had spent hours looking for her. They talked about Joey Gamble and some of the other boys Nicole had dated through high school. Kerber repeatedly asked if Dante dated her or was seeing her on the sly. His questions were more like accusations, and Dante began to worry. Roberta Drum served dinner each night at 7 o'clock, and if for some reason Dante wasn't there, he was expected to call. At 7 p.m., Dante asked the detectives if he could leave. Just a few more questions, Kerber said. Dante asked if he could call his mother. No, cell phones were not permitted inside the police station. After 2 hours in the room, Kerber finally dropped a bomb. He informed Dante that he had a witness willing to testify that Nicole had confided to her close friends that she was seeing Dante and there was a lot of sex involved. But she had to keep it quiet. Her parents would never approve. Her rich father in Dallas would cut off his support and disinherit her. Her church would be scornful, and so on. There was no such witness, but police are permitted to lie at will during an interrogation. Dante strongly denied any relationship with Nicole. And, Kerber went on with his tale, this witness had told them that Nicole was becoming increasingly worried about the affair. She wanted to end it,
but that he, Dante, refused to leave her alone. She thought she was being stalked. She thought Dante had become obsessed with her. Dante vehemently denied all of this. He demanded to know the identity of this witness, but Kerber said it was all confidential. "Your witness is lying," Dante said over and over. As with all interrogations, the detectives knew the direction their questions were headed. Dante did not. Abruptly, Kerber changed subjects and grilled Dante about the green Ford van, and how often he drove it, and where, and so on. It had been in the family for years, and it was shared by the Drum children. Kerber asked how often Dante drove it to school, to the gym, to the mall, and to several other places frequented by high school students. Did Dante drive it to the mall on the night of December 4th, a Friday, the night Nicole disappeared? No. On the night Nicole disappeared, Dante was at home with his younger sister. His parents were in Dallas at a weekend church convention. Dante was babysitting. They ate frozen pizza and watched television in the den, something his mother did not usually allow. Yes, the green van was parked in the driveway. His parents had taken the family's Buick to Dallas. Neighbors testified that the green van was where he said it was. No one saw it leave during the night. His sister testified that he was with her throughout the night, that he did not leave. Kerber informed the suspect that they had a witness who saw a green Ford van in the mall parking lot around the time Nicole disappeared. Dante said there was probably more than one such van in Sloan. He began asking the detectives if he was a suspect. "Do you think I took Nicole?" he asked over and over. When it became evident that they did, he grew extremely agitated. He was also frightened at the thought of being suspected. Around 9 p.m., Roberta Drum was concerned. Dante rarely missed dinner, and he usually kept his cell phone in his pocket. Her calls to him were going straight to voicemail. She began calling his friends, none of whom knew his whereabouts. Kerber asked Dante straight out if he had killed Nicole and disposed of her body. Dante angrily denied this, denied any involvement whatsoever. Kerber said he didn't believe Dante. The exchanges between the two became tense and the language deteriorated. Accusations, denials, accusations, denials. At 9:45 p.m., Kerber kicked back his chair and stormed out of the room. Morrissey put down his pen and apologized for Kerber's behavior. He said the guy was under a lot of stress because he was the lead detective and everybody wanted to know what happened to Nicole. There was a chance she was still alive. Plus, Kerber was a hothead who could be overbearing. It was the classic good cop, bad cop routine, and Dante knew exactly what was going on. But since Morrissey was being polite, Dante chatted with him. They did not discuss the case. Dante asked for a soft drink and something to eat, and Morrissey went to get it. Dante had a good friend by the name of Torrey Pickett. They had played football together since the seventh grade, but Torrey had some legal problems the summer before his junior year. He was caught in a crack-selling sting and sent away. He did not finish high school and was currently working at a grocery store in Sloan. The police knew that Torrey clocked out each weeknight at 10 o'clock, when the store closed. Two uniformed officers were waiting. They asked him if he would voluntarily come down to the station and answer some questions about the Nicole Yarber case. He hesitated, and this made the police suspicious. They told him that his buddy Dante was already down there and needed his help. Torrey decided to go see for himself. He rode in the back seat of a police car. At the station, Torrey was placed in a room two doors down from Dante. The room had a large window with one-way glass so that officers could look in, but the suspect could not see them. It was also wired so that the interrogation could be heard on a speaker in the hall. Detective Needham worked alone and asked the usual generic, non-invasive questions. Torrey quickly waived his Miranda rights. Needham soon got to the topic of girls, and who was dating whom and who was fooling around when they were not supposed to be. Torrey claimed he barely knew Nicole, hadn't seen her in years. He scoffed at the idea that his pal Dante was seeing the girl. After 30 minutes of questioning, Needham left the room. Torrey sat at a table and waited. Meanwhile, in the choir room, Dante was getting another jolt. Kerber informed him they had a witness who was willing to testify that Dante and Torrey Pickett grabbed the girl, raped her in the back of the green van, then tossed her body off a bridge over the Red River. Dante actually laughed at this lunacy,
and his laughter rankled Detective Kerber. Dante explained that he was laughing not about a dead girl, but at the fantasy that Kerber was putting together. If Kerber really had a witness, then he, Kerber, was foolish for believing the lying idiot. The two men called each other liars, among other things. A bad situation became even uglier. Suddenly, Needham opened the door and informed Kerber and Morrissey that he had Torrey Pickett in custody. This news was so exciting that Kerber jumped to his feet and left the room again. Moments later, he was back. He resumed the same line of questioning and accused Dante of the murder. When Dante denied everything, Kerber accused him of lying. He claimed to know for a fact that Dante and Torrey Pickett raped and killed the girl, and if Dante wanted to prove his innocence, then they should start with a polygraph. A lie detector test. It was foolproof, clear evidence, admissible in court, and so on. Dante was immediately suspicious of the test, but at the same time thought it might be a good idea, a quick way to end this foolishness. He knew he was innocent, he knew he could pass the test, and in doing so, he could get Kerber off his back before things got worse. He agreed to an exam. Under the stress of police questioning, innocent people are far likelier to agree to a polygraph. They have nothing to hide, and they're desperate to prove it. Guilty suspects rarely consent to the exams, and for obvious reasons. Dante was led to another room and introduced to a Detective Ferguson, who'd been at home asleep an hour earlier when Detective Needham called. Ferguson was the department's polygraph expert, and he insisted that Kerber, Morrissey, and Needham leave the room. Ferguson was extremely polite, soft-spoken, even apologetic for putting Dante through the process. He explained everything, ran through the paperwork, rigged up the machine, and began asking Dante about his involvement in the Nicole Yarber matter. This went on for about an hour. When Ferguson finished, he explained that it would be a few minutes before he could digest the results. Dante was taken back to the choir room. The results clearly showed that Dante was telling the truth. However, the law, as decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, permits the police to engage in a wide range of deceptive practices during interrogations. They can lie at will. When Kerber returned to the choir room, he was holding the graph paper from the test. He threw it at Dante, hitting him in the face, and called him a lying son of a bitch. Now they had proof that he was lying. They had clear evidence that he snatched his ex-lover, raped her, killed her in a fit of rage, and threw her off a bridge. Kerber picked up the graph paper, shook it in Dante's face, and promised him that when the jury saw the results of the test, they would find him guilty and give him death. "You're looking at the needle," Kerber said over and over. Another lie. Polygraphs are so famously unreliable that their results are never admitted in court. Dante was stunned. He felt faint. He was bewildered and struggled to find words. Kerber relaxed and took his seat across the table. He said that in many cases involving horrible crimes, especially those committed by good, decent folks, non-criminals, the killer subconsciously erases the act from his memory. He just blocks it out. This is quite common, and he, Detective Kerber, because of his extensive training and vast experience, had seen this many times. He suspected that Dante was quite fond of Nicole, maybe even in love, and did not plan to harm her. Things got out of control. She was dead before he realized it. Then he was in shock at what he'd done, and the guilt was crushing. So he tried to block it out. Dante continued to deny everything. He was exhausted and laid his head on the table. Kerber slapped the table violently, startling his suspect. He again accused Dante of the crime, said they had the witnesses and the proof, and that he would be dead within 5 years. Texas prosecutors know how to streamline the system so that the executions are not delayed. Kerber asked Dante to just imagine his mother sitting in the witness room, waving at him for the last time, crying her eyes out as they strapped him down and adjusted the chemicals. "You're a dead man," he said more than once. But there was an option. If Dante would come clean, tell them what happened, make a full confession, then he, Kerber, would guarantee that the state would not seek the death penalty. Dante would get life with no parole, which was no piece of cake, but at least he could write letters to his mom and see her twice a month. Such threats of death and promises of leniency are unconstitutional, and the police know it. Both Kerber and Morrissey denied using these tactics. Not surprisingly, Morrissey's notes make no reference to threats or promises. Nor do they accurately record the time and sequence of events. Dante did not have access to a pen and paper, and after 5 hours of interrogation, lost track of time. Around midnight, Detective Needham opened the door and announced, "Pickett's talking." Kerber smiled at Morrissey, then left in another dramatic exit. Pickett was alone in his locked room, fuming because he'd been forgotten. He had not seen or spoken to anyone in over an hour. Riley Drum found his green van parked at the city jail. He'd been driving the streets and was relieved to find the van. He was also concerned about his son and what kind of trouble he was in. The Sloan City Jail is next door and attached to the police department. Riley went to the jail first and, after some confusion, was told that his son was not behind bars. He had not been processed. There were 62 prisoners back there, none by the name of Dante Drum. The jailer, a younger white officer, recognized Dante's name and was as helpful as possible. He suggested that Mr. Drum check next door with the police department. This he did, and it too proved confusing and frustrating. It was 12:40 a.m. and the front door was locked. Riley called his wife with an update, then he pondered how to get inside the building. After a few minutes, a patrol car parked nearby, and two uniformed officers emerged. They spoke to Riley Drum, who explained why he was there. He followed them inside and took a seat in the lobby. The two officers left in search of his son. Half an hour passed before they reappeared and said that Dante was being questioned. About what? Why? The officers did not know. Riley began waiting. At least the boy was safe. The first crack occurred when Kerber produced a color 8x10 photo of Nicole. Weary, alone, frightened, uncertain, and overwhelmed, Dante took one look at her pretty face and began crying. Kerber and Morrissey exchanged confident smiles. Dante wept for several minutes, then asked to use the restroom. They escorted him down the hall, stopping at the window so he could see Tory Pickett sitting at a table, holding a pen, writing on a legal pad. Dante stared in disbelief, even shook his head and mumbled something to himself. Tory wrote a one-page summary in which he denied knowing anything about Nicole Yarber's disappearance. The summary was somehow misplaced by the Sloan Police Department and has never been seen. Back in the choir room, Kerber informed Dante that his pal Tory had signed a statement in which he swore, under oath, that Dante was seeing Nicole, that he was crazy about her, but she was worried about the consequences and trying to break up. Dante was desperate and stalking the girl. Tory was afraid he might hurt her. As Kerber delivered this latest series of lies, he read from a sheet of paper as if it were Tory's statement. Dante closed his eyes, shook his head, and tried to understand what was happening. But his thoughts were much slower now, his reaction time deadened by fatigue and fear. He asked if he could leave, and Kerber yelled at him. The detective cursed him and said no, he could not leave, because he was their prime suspect. He was their man. They had the proof. Dante asked if he needed a lawyer, and Kerber said of course not. A lawyer can't change the facts. A lawyer can't bring back Nicole. A lawyer can't save your life, Dante, but we can. Morrissey's notes make no reference to the discussion about lawyers. At 2:20 a.m., Tory Pickett was allowed to leave. Detective Needham led him through a side door so he would not bump into Mr. Drum in the lobby. The detectives in the basement had been warned that the defendant's father was in the building and wanted to see him. This was denied under oath at several hearings. Morrissey began to fade and was replaced by Needham. For the next 3 hours, while Morrissey napped, Needham took notes. Kerber showed no signs of slowing down. As he hammered away at the suspect, he seemed to energize himself. He was about to break the suspect, solve the case, and become the hero. He offered Dante another crack at the polygraph, this one to be limited solely to the question of his whereabouts on Friday, December 4th at approximately 10 p.m. Dante's first reaction was to say no, to distrust the machine. but such wisdom was overridden by the desire to get out of the room. Just get away from Kerber, anything to get the cycle out of his face. Detective Ferguson hooked him up to the machine again and asked a few questions. The polygraph made its noises, its graph paper slowly rolled out. Dante stared at it without a clue, but something told him the results would not be good. Again, the results proved he was telling the truth. He was at home that Friday, babysitting, and he never left. But the truth was not important. While he was away, Kerber moved his chair to a corner, as far from the door as possible. When Dante returned, he took his place and Kerber pulled his chair close so that their knees were practically touching. He began cursing Dante again, telling him he had not only flunked the second polygraph, but severely flunked it. For the first time, he touched Dante by jabbing his right index finger into his chest. Dante slapped his hand away and was ready to fight when Needham stepped forward with a taser. The detective seemed anxious to give it a try, but did not. Both cops cursed and threatened Dante. The jabbing continued, along with the nonstop accusations and threats. Dante realized he would not be allowed to leave until he gave the cops what they wanted. And maybe they were right after all. They seemed so certain about what happened. They were convinced beyond any doubt that he was involved. His own friend was saying that he and Nicole were involved in a relationship, and the polygraphs. What would the jury think when they learned that he had lied? Dante was doubting himself and his own memory. What if he had blacked out and erased the terrible deed? And he really didn't want to die. Not then, not 5 or 10 years down the road. At 4 a.m., Riley Drum left the police station and went home. He tried to sleep but could not. Roberta made coffee and they worried and waited for sunrise, as if things would clear up then. Kerber and Needham took a break at 4:30 a.m. When they were alone in the hallway, Kerber said,
"He's ready."
A few minutes later, Needham opened the door quietly and peeked in. Dante was lying on the floor, sobbing. They took him a donut and a soft drink and resumed the interrogation. A revelation slowly came over Dante. Since he could not leave until he gave them their story, and since he would, at that moment, confess to killing his own mother, why not play along? Nicole would turn up soon enough, dead or alive, and this would solve the mystery. The police would look like fools for verbally beating a confession out of him. Some farmer or hunter would stumble over her remains, and these clowns would be exposed. Dante would be vindicated, freed, and everyone would feel sorry for him. 12 hours after the interrogation began, he looked at Kerber and said, "Give me a few minutes, and I'll tell you everything." After the break, Kerber helped him fill in the blanks. He had sneaked out of the house after his sister was asleep. He was desperate to see Nicole because she was pushing him away, trying to break off their affair. He knew Nicole was at the movies with friends. He drove there alone in the green Ford van. He confronted her in the parking lot near her car. She agreed to get in. They drove around Sloan, then into the countryside. He wanted sex. She said no. They were finished. He tried to force himself on her and she fought back. He forced her into sex, but it wasn't enjoyable. She scratched him, even drew blood. The attack turned ugly. He flew into a rage, began to choke her, and he couldn't stop, didn't stop until it was too late. Then he panicked. He had to do something with her. He yelled at her back in the rear of the van, but she never responded. He drove north toward Oklahoma. He'd lost track of time, then realized that dawn was approaching. He had to get home. He had to get rid of her body. On the Route 244 bridge over the Red River, at approximately 6 o'clock on the morning of December 5th, he stopped the van. It was still dark. She was still very dead. He tossed her over and waited until he heard the sickening splash below. He cried all the way back to Sloan. For 3 hours, Kerber coached him, prodded him, corrected him, cursed him, reminded him to tell the truth. The details had to be perfect, Kerber kept saying. At 8:21 a.m., the video camera was finally turned on. A wiped-out, stone-faced Dante Drum sat at the table with a fresh soft drink and a donut in front of him, visible. so that their hospitality could be shown. The video ran for 17 minutes and would send him to death row. Dante was charged with abduction, aggravated rape, and capital murder. He was taken to a cell where he promptly fell asleep. At 9 a.m., the chief of police, along with the district attorney, Mr. Paul Coffey, held a press conference to announce the Nicole Yarber case had been solved. Sadly, one of Sloan's former football heroes, Dante Drum, had confessed to the murder. Other witnesses verified his involvement. Sympathies to her family. The confession was attacked immediately. Dante recanted, and his attorney, Robbie Flack, went public with a scathing condemnation of the police and their tactics. Months later, the defense lawyers filed motions to suppress the confession, and the suppression hearing lasted for a week. Kerber, Morrissey, and Needham testified at length, and their testimony was hotly challenged by the defense. They steadfastly denied using threats, promises, or intimidation. They specifically denied using the death penalty as a means to frighten Dante into cooperating. They denied verbally abusing the suspect or pushing him to the point of exhaustion and collapse. They denied that Dante had ever mentioned a lawyer or that he wanted to terminate the interrogation and go home. They denied any knowledge of his father's presence at the station and his desire to see his son. They denied the fact that their own polygraph tests showed clear evidence of truthfulness, but instead testified that the results were inconclusive in their opinions. They denied any trickery with the alleged statement of Torrey Pickett. Pickett testified on Dante's behalf and denied telling the police anything about an affair between Dante and Nicole. The trial judge expressed grave concerns about the confession, but not grave enough to exclude it from the trial. She refused to suppress it, and it was later shown to the jury. Dante watched it as if he were watching a different person. No one has ever seriously questioned the fact that it guaranteed his conviction. The confession was attacked again on appeal, but the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals unanimously affirmed the conviction and death sentence. When Keith was finished, he left the table and went to the bathroom. He had the feeling that he had just been interrogated. It was well after midnight. Sleep would be impossible. Chapter 8. By 7 o'clock on Tuesday morning, the Flack Law Firm was bustling with a frantic, nervous energy one might expect from a group of people fighting both the clock and some very long odds to save a man's life. Tension was palpable. There were no smiles, none of the usual smart-ass remarks from people who worked together each day with the absolute freedom of saying anything to anyone at any time. Most of those present had been around 6 years earlier when Lamar Billups got the needle at Huntsville, and the finality of his death had been a shock. And Billups had been a nasty character. His favorite pastime had been beating up people in bar fights, preferably with pool cue sticks and broken bottles, and the state finally got fed up with him. On his deathbed, his last words were, "See you in hell," and away he went. He was guilty, and never made a serious claim otherwise. His murder had been in a small town 60 miles away, hardly noticed by the citizens of Sloan. He had no family, no one for the firm to be acquainted with. Robbie disliked him immensely, but clung rigidly to the belief that the state had no right to kill him. The state of Texas versus Dante Drum was a far different matter. Now they were fighting for an innocent man, and his family was their family. The long table in the main conference room was the center of the storm. Fred Pryor, who was still in Houston, was on the speakerphone, giving a quick update on his efforts to flip Joey Gamble. The two had spoken by phone late Monday night, and Gamble was even less cooperative.
"He kept asking about perjury and how serious a crime it is," Pryor said, his voice at full volume.
"Coffee's threatening him," Robbie said, as if he knew it to be true. "Did you ask him if he's talking to the district attorney?"
"No, but I thought about it," Pryor replied. "I didn't because I figured he would not divulge that."
"Coffey knows he lied at trial, and he's told the kid that we'll make a last-minute run at him," Robbie said. "He's threatened him with a prosecution for perjury if he changes his story now. Want to bet on that, Fred?"
"Nope. Sounds about right."
Tell Joey the statute of limitations is run on perjury. Coffee can't touch him.
You got it.
The speakerphone was switched off. A platter of pastries hit the table and attracted a crowd. Robbie's two associates, both women, were reviewing a request for a reprieve from the governor. Martha Handler sat at one end of the table, lost in the world of trial transcripts. Aaron Ray, with his jacket off and both pistols visible and strapped to his shirt, sipped coffee from a paper cup as he scanned the morning newspaper. Bonnie, a paralegal, worked at a laptop.
"Let's assume Gamble comes through," Robbie said to his senior associate, a prim lady of undetermined age.
Robbie had sued her first plastic surgeon 20 years earlier when a facelift produced a result that was less than desirable. But she had not given up on the corrective work. She had simply changed surgeons. Her name was Samantha Thomas, or Sammy, and when she wasn't working on Robbie's cases, she was suing doctors for malpractice and employers for age and race discrimination.
"Get the petition ready just in case," he said.
"I'm almost finished with it," Sammy said.
The receptionist, Fanta, a tall, slender black woman who had starred in basketball at Sloan High and would have graduated under different circumstances, with both Nicole Yarber and Dante Drum, entered the room with a handful of phone messages.
"A reporter from the Washington Post called and wants to talk," she said to Robbie, who immediately focused on her legs.
"Is it someone we know?"
"Never seen the name before."
"Then ignore."
"A reporter from the Houston Chronicle left a message at 10:30 last night."
"It's not Spinny, is it?"
"It is."
"Tell him to go to hell."
"I don't use that language."
"Then ignore."
"Greta's called 3 times.
"Is she still in Germany?"
"Yes, she can't afford the plane ticket. She wants to know if she and Dante can get married through the internet."
"And what did you tell her?"
"I said no, it's not possible."
"Did you explain that Dante has become one of the most eligible bachelors in the world? That he's had at least 5 marriage proposals in the past week? All from Europe? All kinds of women, young, old, fat, skinny. The only trait they share is that they're ugly and stupid. Did you explain that Dante is rather particular about whom he marries and so he's taking his time?"
"I didn't talk to her. She left a voicemail."
"Good. Ignore."
"The last one is from a minister from a Lutheran church in Topeka, Kansas. Called 10 minutes ago, said he might have information about who killed Nicole, but is not sure what to do about it."
"Great, another nut. How many of those did we have last week?"
"I've lost count."
"Ignore."
"It's amazing how many fruitcakes show up at the last minute."
She placed the messages amid the pile of debris in front of Robbie and left the room. Robbie watched every step of her exit, but did not gawk as usual. Martha Handler said,
"I don't mind calling the fruitcakes."
"You're just looking for material," Robbie shot back. "It's a waste of valuable time."
"Morning news," Carlos, the paralegal, said loudly and reached for the remote control. He aimed it at a widescreen television hanging in a corner, and the chatter stopped. The reporter was standing in front of the Chester County Courthouse, as if something dramatic might happen there at any minute. He gushed. "City officials are mum on their plans to deal with potential unrest here in Sloan in the wake of the scheduled execution of Dante Drum. Drum, as you know, was convicted in 1999 of the aggravated rape and murder of Nicole Yarber, and pending a last-minute stay or reprieve, will be executed at the prison in Huntsville at 6 o'clock, Thursday evening. Drum has maintained his innocence, and many here in Sloan do not believe he is guilty. From the beginning, the case has had racial overtones, and to say the town is divided is quite an understatement. I'm here with Police Chief Joe Radford."
The camera pulled back to reveal the rotund figure of the chief in uniform.
"Chief, what can we expect if the execution is carried out?"
"Well, I guess we can expect justice to be served."
"Do you anticipate trouble?"
"Not at all. Folks have got to understand that the judicial system works and that the verdict of the jury must be carried out."
"So you don't foresee any problems Thursday night?"
"No. But we'll be out in full force. We'll be ready."
"Thanks for your time."
The camera zoomed in, cutting out the chief.
Organizers are planning a protest tomorrow at noon right here in front of the courthouse. Sources confirmed that a permit for a rally has been issued by City Hall. More on that later. The reporter signed off, and the paralegal pushed the mute button. No comment from Robbie, and everybody went back to work. The Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles has 7 members, all appointed by the governor. An inmate desiring clemency must petition the board for relief. Petition may be as simple as a 1-page request, or as thorough as a voluminous filing with exhibits, affidavits, and letters from around the world. The one filed by Robbie Flack on behalf of Dante Drum was one of the most exhaustive in the board's history. Clemency is rarely granted. If denied, an appeal can be made to the governor, who cannot grant clemency on his own initiative, but is allowed to issue 1 30-day reprieve. On those rare occasions when the board grants clemency, the governor has the right to overrule it, and the state proceeds with the execution. For a condemned prisoner facing death, the board usually makes its decision 2 days before the execution. The board doesn't actually meet to take a vote, but instead circulates a ballot by fax. Death by fax, as it is known. For Dante Drum, the news of his death by fax came at 8:15 on Tuesday morning. Robbie read the decision aloud to his team. No one was remotely surprised. They had lost so many rounds by now that a victory was not something they expected. "So let's ask the governor for a reprieve," Robbie said with a smile. "I'm sure he'll be happy to hear from us again." Of the truckload of motions and petitions and requests that his firm had filed in the last month, and would continue to churn out until his client was dead, a request for a reprieve from the governor of Texas was undoubtedly the biggest waste of paper. Twice in the past year, the governor had ignored clemency approvals from his parole board and allowed the executions. He loved the death penalty, especially when seeking votes. One of his campaigns featured the slogan, "Tough Texas Justice," and included his promise to empty death row. And he was not talking about early parole. "Let's go see Dante," Robbie announced. The drive from Sloan to the Polunsky unit near Livingston, Texas, was a hard 3-hour grind on 2-lane roads. Robbie had made it 100 times. A few years earlier, when he had 3 clients on death row, Dante, Lamar Billups, and a man named Cole Taylor, he grew weary of speeding tickets and rural drivers and near misses because he was on the phone. He bought a van, a long, heavy one with plenty of room, and he took it to a high-end custom shop in Fort Worth, where they installed phones, televisions, and every gadget on the market, along with plush carpet, fine leather captain's chairs that both swiveled and reclined, a sofa in the rear if Robbie needed a nap, and a bar in case he became thirsty. Aaron Ray was named the designated driver. Bonnie, the other paralegal, usually sat in the front passenger seat, ready to jump when Mr. Flack barked. The trips became much more productive as Robbie worked the phone and laptop or read briefs on the way to Polunsky and back, traveling comfortably in the portable office. His chair was directly behind the driver's. Next to him was Martha Handler. Up front with Aaron was Bonnie. They left Sloan at 8:30 a.m. and were soon winding through the hills of East Texas. The fifth member of the team was a new one. Her name was Dr. Christina Hines, or Christy, as she was called around the Flack office, where no one was presumptuous enough to wear a title and most first names were shortened. She was the latest in a series of experts Robbie had burned cash on in his efforts to save Dante. She was a clinical psychiatrist who studied prisoners and prison conditions, and she'd written a book that argued, among other things, solitary confinement is one of the worst forms of torture. For $10,000, she was expected to meet with Dante, evaluate him, then prepare, quickly, a report in which she would describe his deteriorated mental condition and declare that, 1, he had been driven crazy by 8 years of solitary, and 2, such confinement constitutes cruel and unusual punishment. In 1986... the U.S. Supreme Court stopped the execution of insane people. Robbie's final thrust would be to portray Dante as a psychotic schizoid who understood nothing. The argument was a long shot. Christy Hines was only 32 years old, not far removed from the classroom, with a resume that included no experience in court. Robbie was not concerned. He only hoped she got the chance to testify in a hearing on mental competency, months down the road. She had the rear sofa, papers spread everywhere, hard at work like everyone else. When Robbie finished a phone call, Martha Handler said, "Can we talk?" This had become her standard opening when she had questions. "Sure," he said. She clicked on one of her many tape recorders and slid it in front of him. "On the subject of money, you were appointed by the judge to represent Dante, who qualified as an indigent defendant, but..."
"Yep, Texas has no public defender system to speak of," he interrupted.
After months together, Martha had learned that she should never expect to finish a sentence. He went on. "So the local judges appoint their buddies or drag in some poor schmuck when the case is so bad no one wants it. Me, I went to the judge and volunteered. She was happy to give it to me. No other lawyer in town would get near it."
"But the drums are not exactly poor. They both..."
"Sure, but here's how it works. Only a rich person can afford to pay a lawyer for a capital defense, and there are no rich people on death row. I could have squeezed $5,000 or $10,000 out of the family, made them mortgage their house again, something like that, but why bother? The fine folks of Chester County would pay. This is one of the great ironies of the death penalty. The people want the death penalty, something like 70% in this state. Yet they have no idea how much they're paying for it."
"How much have they paid?" she asked, deftly inserting the question before he could start talking again.
"Oh, I don't know, a lot. Bonnie, how much have we been paid so far?"
With no hesitation and hardly a glance over her shoulder, Bonnie said, "Almost $400,000. Robbie went on, barely skipping a beat. "That includes attorney's fees at the rate of $125 an hour, plus expenses, primarily for investigators, and then a nice chunk for expert witnesses."
"That's a lot of money," Martha said.
"It is and it isn't. When a law firm is working for $125 an hour, it's losing serious money. I'll never do it again. I can't afford it. Neither can the taxpayers. But at least I know I'm losing my ass. They do not. Ask the average Joe on Main Street in Sloan how much he and his fellow citizens have paid to prosecute Dante Drum, and you know what he'll say?"
"How am I supposed to?"
"He'll say he doesn't have a clue. Have you heard about the Thule boys in West Texas? It's a famous case. I'm sorry, I must have missed. These two brothers..."